everyone. Welcome to Unpacking Zionism. I'm Jesse Daniels, writer, professor, and member of the founding collective of ICSC, the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism. This is the fourth episode in our five-part series, The Trouble with White Feminism. And today, we're reversing the roles from the previous episode. So, Kim Hung Nguyen, professor at University of Waterloo and author of Mean Girl Feminism, is asking me questions about my most recent book, Nice White Ladies. In this conversation, we get into some of the white lady celebrities who quickly showed up on the political landscape in the days after October 7th, 2023, to stake a claim on their brand of feminism in service of Zionism. As a warning to listeners, there is discussion of sexual violence throughout this episode, and if that's too much, just skip this one and listen to the next one. As another reminder for listeners, we recorded this conversation in early August 2024, long before the U.S. election and before Israel invaded Lebanon. Kim, over to you.
Welcome. Today we are sitting down with Jesse Daniels, who is a full professor of sociology at Hunter College and a founding member of the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism. Thank you, Jesse, for joining us.
Great to be here.
What is the climate like where you are for speaking out against Zionism?
Yeah, we've had a real struggle here on our campus. There was a screening of a film back in November that was already scheduled when the attack on October 7th happened. And the president of our college canceled that, the screening of the film Israelism. And so there was a whole lot of organizing around that to get it rescheduled. And we did successfully do that. So I'm very proud of the organizing that's been going on here on our campus to push back against the Zionism. And it's also been very personal in a lot of ways. I early on signed on to a letter in support of the Palestinian people. I actually don't even remember what the letter was, but some far-right Zionist group grabbed all of the signatures and names on that letter and then started a smear campaign. And that included, you know, circling our campus with one of those LED trucks. And everyone on the list, they grabbed our photo from the campus website and they malicious websites for each one of us. And the LED truck that circled the campus had as the banner above each one of our names, CUNY's leading anti-Semites. And CUNY is part of, you know, Hunter College is part of CUNY, which is the City University of New York. And so, you know, that was frightening. It was enraging. And it was across, you know, several faculty, staff, and students. Unfortunately, and I think this is emblematic of what's happening in higher ed across the U.S., there was no response. There was no formal response from our university, either at Hunter College or from CUNY Central, you know, in support of the people who were being attacked. And since then, there's been a real push, you know, really aligned with these forces of the far right to, you know, supposedly root out the anti-Semites on campus. And it's really just a cover for, you know, for Zionism and pushing a Zionist agenda on campus. So it feels very tense and fraught and a little dangerous right now, frankly.
Yeah. One of the pieces of conversation that we've had in Ontario and at my campus very briefly, though it hasn't been extensive, is how universities are just really invested in faculty to amplify their research in public channels, but are just astonishingly ill-equipped to deal with the pushback from that amplification of our research, you know, whether that be in op-eds or whether that be through, you know, Twitter or through, you know, the public learning about the content of our classes.
There's a long history there. And it wasn't the first time that I've been attacked by the far right. And it's the same pattern, right? Just as you explained, the university is very happy to take the benefit when I appear on a news program or I'm quoted in the press. But when I get attacked for that, there is a distance and a sort of like, well, yeah, what do you expect us to do kind of response?
Yeah. So one of the most delightful things that I learned about you in reading your first book, White Lies, where you talk about changing your name after learning your own history and racial positioning in Texas. And Texas seems like an important place for you to theorize significant concepts that emerge from growing up in Texas in Nice White Ladies. Why is Texas particularly an important site for your thinking then and now? And what is it about Texas that encourages you to deep or maybe even revive your commitment?
Yeah, so Texas is an interesting place. You know, the PR for Texas is that it's like a whole other country, and it kind of is in some ways like a different nation state within the U.S. And you mentioned that I changed my name, and I should say that my namesake, my chosen namesake, is a historical figure who was actually from Texas, and her name is Jessie Daniel Ames. And I just took her first two names. And part of the reason that I wanted to change my name in sort of an homage to her is that she had done something remarkable, which was that she started something called the Association of Southern Women for the Prevention of Lynching. And she started this activist group in 1930, so it's late into the violence that was lynching. But what struck me about that was that this was a white woman from the same place I was from, and ironically from a little town in Texas called Palestine. And I don't actually know the history of why that little town is called that. But what Jessie Daniel Ames did was that she mobilized white women around lynching to say, this is a practice, this is a reign of terror, this is a violence that's being enacted in our names. And what she meant by that was this fact, you know, that Ida B. Wells Barnett uncovered in her research in a series of documents called The Red Record, in which she investigated lynching. And the excuse often given was that a white woman had been raped by a black man. And so therefore, you know, people wanted to take care of business and take care of the black man who had supposedly raped a white woman. But what Ida B. Wells Barnett investigated and found out was that that was what she called a threadbare lie. It wasn't true that this was happening. And so part of what Jessie Daniel Ames did was that she said, not in our name, like, you're not going to use the sort of banner of white women and protecting us and white women's innocence or supposed innocence in this racial regime to enact this violence. And, you know, it was late. Who's to say what kind of actual impact it had on lynching. But the fact of it, the fact of the organization really inspired me. Part of what I was trying to do with changing my name was to get away from the legacy in my family of settler colonialism, vigilante racism, and a false claim to indigeneity. So let me just really quickly tell you about my family. My great-grandfather moved from Kansas to Oklahoma, and that move was enabled by something called the Homestead Act. And in our family, there was a kind of pride at sharing the fact that, you know, the great-grandfather had made the run into Oklahoma. But making the run into Oklahoma was really about stealing land that belonged to Native Americans, that belonged to indigenous people. So that was my great-grandfather. My grandfather, this is all my father's side, my grandfather, I discovered in the middle of doing my dissertation on the Klan, had been a member of the Klan. I didn't know that growing up, and he was not a person that I enjoyed being around as a kid for lots of different reasons. So that was my grandfather. And then my father, so great-grandfather, grandfather, father, my father raised me with this false belief that he was Cherokee. Right. So, I mean, I literally learned about the Trail of Tears from my father, you know, as he wiped away tears, as if we, our ancestors, had been on it. And that pattern of settler to vigilante to claims of, you know, being indigenous, I think is one that we see playing out now in Palestine. So that's my family story. And part of the reason I wanted to change my name in honor of Jessie Daniel Ames was to distance myself from that legacy that I had, you know, inherited from my family, and to also create a new pattern. I wanted to break that cycle.
So as an aside, when I was reading about what you wrote in White Lies, and, you know, that I read White Lies after Nice White Ladies, I then wrote the conclusion to Mean Girl Feminism, and I wrote about Jessie Daniel Ames, and I was like, I really want to be about Jessie Daniels and talking about her and changing her name. I really wanted to do that. But at that time, we didn't know each other. So I didn't do that.
So one of the other things I wanted to say is that part of what I grew up understanding is that there was a certain level of acceptable violence in the culture. And it's, you know, there are some things about that that are Texas flavor, that there are some things that are specific to Texas. And for example, one of the things that was common in my life, in my family, was going to the rodeo in Huntsville. And now the rodeo is not just a Texas tradition, but it's part of the sort of Western U.S. Frontier culture. But the rodeo in Huntsville, Texas, is very specific because it's a prison rodeo. And so the people who are, you know, doing the calf roping and the bull riding and all that are actually inmates in the Texas State Prison that's at Huntsville. I grew up, our family would go to that. And even though this is a practice that's sort of steeped in a kind of violence, the attitude or the idea behind us going was a kind of, isn't it nice of us to go and watch these prisoners have this day out of their cells, right? So that kind of thing was just taken for granted in the culture in which I grew up in. And there was a kind of, along with that, a kind of entitlement to land and other people's resources and other people's bodies and taking them violently. So we're recording this in August of 2024. Just 2 months ago in June, there was a woman in Texas named Elizabeth Wolf, who at an apartment complex in suburban Dallas-Fort Worth attempted to drown two children because their mother, a Palestinian American woman, happened to be wearing a hijab. And this woman began hitting the mother, pulled off her hijab, starts hitting her with the hijab, and then tries to drown her two children in the pool of this apartment complex. And that story just really got to me because to me, it speaks to something of the culture of violence. And also in the US, it's by no means unique to Texas. But to me, the question is really why? Why this kind of violent behavior from white women, including white Jewish women? So just yesterday, here in New York City, where I live now, a white Jewish woman by the name of Karen Lichtbron assaulted and pepper sprayed a whole bunch of Palestinian protesters, including several children, at a demonstration in Times Square. And this, you know, according to several reports, she got stopped by the police, but then immediately released. So to me, there's some kind of overlap happening between white women who are engaged in this kind of violent behavior in public and the Zionist, often Jewish women who are engaged in the same sort of thing. And I think the question really remains why. And we can talk about that.
Speaking of this celebration of violence by white Jewish women, right after October 7th, there were three white lady celebrities who start becoming visible, not for their talents as actor or comedian or in tech, but as advocates for Israel. Deborah Messing, Sheryl Sandberg, and Amy Schumer. What happened on and after October 7th for white Zionist feminism?
Yeah, so that was a real moment for a lot of people. And I think that for these, just talking about these three celebrities in particular, I mean, one of the things I've really talked to several people about and have noticed, let me just say that, is that I don't think I realized Deborah Messing, Amy Schumer, and Sheryl Sandberg were Jewish until after October 7th. So first of all, there's a kind of outward and very public embrace of Jewishness that's tied specifically to October 7th for these people. And not only is it a Jewish identity, but it's an attachment to Israel. So it's not just a religious or community identity, it's a state-aligned identity. So it's not just I'm Jewish and these are my religious practices, but I'm Jewish and no matter what Israel does, I support Israel. And then the other thing that happened after October 7th is that there was a real focus among all three of these celebrities, but especially Sheryl Sandberg, around sexual violence. And this, in a lot of ways, was driven by reporting from the New York Times. So the New York Times did a piece in the fall of 2023. I'm not sure of the exact date, but they did a piece called Screams Without Words. And this reporting was supposedly documenting sexual assault that had happened against Israeli citizens. And then that original report got sort of promoted by several other writers at the New York Times, including Bret Stephens, who's sort of a well-known far-right columnist for the New York Times, and Jill Filipovic, who is more sort of center-left and, you know, supposedly one of their gender correspondents. But they both, you know, sort of endorsed that original reporting from the New York Times, even though that reporting has been discredited now. What Sheryl Sandberg did was she took that kind of reverberation effect that Bret Stephens and Jill Filipovic did, and she amplified it by making a documentary called Screams Before Silence. And this documentary, which is available online and it's actually been shown at the White House, replays the discredited lies of the New York Times reporting in this very emotionally evocative kind of way. Now, it's very hard, I think, for many feminists to understand how to approach this analytically because, you know, feminism has really brought sexual assault into the public sphere to say, this is not just a private matter, this is a public matter that we should be discussing. The problem with what Sheryl Sandberg and these other celebrities are doing around this use of sexual violence is that there are only some forms of sexual assault which are deemed problematic, and there are only some people who are considered real victims of sexual assault. And those people are only ever white, Jewish, Israeli women. That is the only kind of victim in Sheryl Sandberg's film, Screams Before Silence. And that's who we're meant to focus on as the person or the category of people who is worthy of our concern, our outrage, our, you know, disgust at sexual violence, right? In a way, it weaponizes sexual violence in the service of Zionism.
And by implication, there is only one perpetrator in this situation as well.
Exactly. And the perpetrator identified sort of again and again, like relentlessly in that film, is not just, you know, Palestinians. It's not even just Hamas. It's always Hamas terrorists, again and again and again. And there's a real dehumanizing way in which that phrase gets repeated, and it's inherently racist. It's the same kind of thing that happened here in the United States around Black men who were seen as inherently rapists, and white women who were seen as inherently desirable by Black men and therefore especially subject to rape. At the same time that Black women were not considered rapable under the law. There was no jurisdiction. There was no law in which Black women could come forward and say, I have been raped, often by a white man. That wasn't legible, you know, within the legal system in the United States. And it's the same kind of equation happening with white, Jewish, Israeli women and the quote unquote Hamas terrorists who are the rapists. This is really difficult stuff to talk about, but I think it's important. One of the things that I learned in doing a master's thesis about lynching was when I investigated historical record, oftentimes the published accounts about what happened at a lynching would just say, you know, a Black man's body had been mutilated. And then when you read the accounts of people who were there, what you realize is that they had been sexually assaulted, that their genitals had often been removed and you know, lots and lots of other things that it's just, you know, difficult to talk about. But I think it's important because it was not only a violent attack, it was a sexually violent attack. And part of what we know that's happening in Palestine has been happening for decades is that sexual violence is part of what the Israeli military uses to subjugate. And this is not exclusive to women or men. It is women and men and children who are routinely sexually assaulted by Israeli military. And just in the last week, we have seen not just the military, but Israeli far-right politicians and citizens who have shown up at a detention center rioting basically for the right to sexually assault Palestinians in custody. And that's the kind of disconnect that white imperial feminism cannot take in. It can't make sense of that because it's using this gender-only lens, right? And I think that there are people who are beginning to see and understand that this is happening. I mean, there are reporters who, you know, are coming out and saying things like, I feel stupid and ashamed that I didn't understand this, but we need much more of that kind of realization to start happening to shift this political situation.
So perhaps we should go back a bit to talk about the relationship between whiteness and Zionism. I know that many Jewish folks find being situated as white uncomfortable. Why do critical race scholars, yourself and me included here, insist on theorizing how whiteness as a racial formation has evolved to envelop Jewish positionality? And what does that do to Zionism?
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me when I was first a professor and teaching on Long Island, and many of my students, in fact, I would say the vast majority of my students were what sociologists refer to as white ethnics. And this is typically, you know, Italians, Russian, Irish, and Jewish immigrants who were in that big bubble of immigration that came to the U.S. between 1890 and 1920. And many of their descendants now live on Long Island, just outside of New York, where I started teaching. And I used to do this exercise in class where I would get students to interview their parents about their history of immigration, how they relate to whiteness. And it was always a dilemma for the Jewish students to ask their relatives, are we white? And I found it fascinating in a lot of ways. And there's a book about that came out about that time by Karen Brodkin called How the Jews Became White Folks and What That Says About Race in America. And part of what she discusses in that book is what she calls Euroethnics. So those groups that I just mentioned, how they became white. And part of that was really structural. It was part of what the U.S. government was doing with the GI Bill, which was this legislation meant to help reward mostly men who had served in the military after World War II. But the way that the legislation was written was intentionally advantaged white people and disadvantaged Black people. So those suburbs on Long Island, just outside of New York, like Levittown, were really created partly through the GI Bill and suburbanization funded through the Federal Housing Administration. But those were whites-only communities. I mean, there's lots and lots of documentation of Black New Yorkers who would go out to Long Island and say, I too would like a part of this suburban American dream, but they were denied. So they weren't able to buy into those houses. What it meant for people who were able to buy into it and often left the city is that they also bought into the whiteness of the suburban American dream. Right. So it's useful, I think, to consider whiteness as a kind of structure that helps to sort resources and to which some people become emotionally attached. And so I think it's important if we do that shift, instead of just thinking of white as an individual racial identity, if we think about whiteness as a structure that sorts resources and which people become emotionally attached to. It's the same with Zionism. You know, emotion is really at the heart of all national movements, and Zionism is no exception. So I think that there's a way in which for people who were Jewish, who were perhaps fleeing the Holocaust and came to America as immigrants, either after World War II or earlier, in those earlier waves of immigration, that through these structures, they could have access to what resources whiteness enabled for them. And there's a way in which that emotional attachment follows those resources. And I think it's the same thing going on with Zionism. There are resources attached to being a Zionist, and people get attached to those.
You write succinctly that, quote, white feminism functions like a war machine, and that it wants to accomplish feminist goals in and through the state. Why do you think American feminists like Sandberg, Messing, and Schumer are so invested in Palestine? And what kinds of American feminist goals can get accomplished through Israel's displacement, apartheid, and genocide?
Yeah, it's a good question. Like, why be so invested in Palestine, and why not be horrified by the atrocities that are happening? And I think part of the answer has to do with one's orientation to the state. And in this case of the U.S., Israel is not just any nation state. It's connected to the U.S. as an outpost of American empire, right? And I think for me, one of the most interesting things I've learned since October 7th is that before Israel was created in 1948, Palestinians refer to as the Nakba, the catastrophe. There was an earlier proposal around 1903 known as the Uganda Scheme to create a Jewish state in East Africa. But the geography of that wasn't suitable to the empire, you know, the imperial interest of Britain and the U.S., who saw oil in the Middle East, also kind of a misnomer, right? Middle of what? East of where? But Britain and the U.S. saw placing Israel, a Jewish state, within that oil-rich region as in their strategic interest, right? So when women like Sandberg, Messing, and Schumer, you know, who have now become more identifiably Jewish in the wake of October 7th, begin embracing that identity, they do so in a way that aligns with the goals of empire. And so one of the aspects of this alignment of these celebrities with empire is how conscious these celebrities are about this alignment with empire. In many ways, it doesn't matter because they're doing the work of empire, whether they realize it or not. But for me, this suggests something deeper happening than the rational, logical mind. And if you'll allow me, I want to just sort of talk a little bit about the psychoanalytic, which I increasingly think is important in my work and I think for what we're witnessing happening right now. So in the Nice White Lady's book, I talk about the sadomasochism at the heart of the settler colonial project. And part of the way that I began to think about this and understand it was really through this marvelous and harrowing book called They Were Her Property by Stephanie Jones Rogers. And
love that book.
It's so powerful. And part of what was so world shifting to me about that book is I was really taught this version of gender and women's studies that positioned white women as only ever victims and never perpetrators of oppression. And so the idea that white women could never own property was sort of a taken for granted of that version of gendered women's studies that I got taught in graduate school. And what Stephanie Jones Rogers does by looking at the historical records of slavery in the U.S. is that white women of a certain class were very much slave owners. Often they would get enslaved people handed down through inheritance from their fathers, and then they would use that inheritance to broker a more advantageous marriage partner, right? So it would be like part of their dowry that they owned these people. The thing that Jones Rogers unveils from the historical record is that white women were particularly cruel in their administration of slavery. And that stood out to me because it made me think about my family, honestly. And I had a grandmother, now this is my family on my mother's side, I had a grandmother on my mother's side who was a sadist. There's really no other way to talk about it. She was an evil and violent person who enjoyed seeing the suffering of others. Now, I didn't come from the kind of class background of people who could have owned slaves, but people rented slaves. I don't know if you know that, but in the U.S., there was a practice of renting out enslaved people. And I'm pretty sure that that's what my family was probably doing. And so there's a way in which that legacy of slavery, of lynching, that continues through generations. And it is part of what we inherit as settlers, right? Is this learning to inflict pain, learning to ignore the suffering of others. And you see this in lots of different places. I mean, people who are of a certain age will remember Lindy England, who was a working class American soldier. And she was one of the people who was photographed torturing an Iraqi soldier at a Iraqi captive at Abu Ghraib. And she had like a dog leash around this man who is undressed and has a hood over his head. And she's smiling and giving a thumbs up to the camera, right? And there are lots of ways that we can understand this in terms of individual psychology. But I think that we have to look at the psychology of settlers and what these institutions and these practices do to us. And I think it's the same with lynch mobs in the US. There's a kind of pervasive sadism in settler cultures. There's a marvelous piece, you know, marvelous and harrowing, like Stephanie Jones Rogers by Mary Tufaa, just in the last couple of months. And she talks about the IDF, the Israeli military, and I'm sure people listening to this have seen the soldiers dancing with, you know, the undergarments of Palestinian people that they've arrested or killed, and the kind of grotesque displays that are going on. And the phrase that struck me is that Tufaa uses in this piece is the pervasive sadism. And that made me think of lynching and slavery in my own family. She writes, the pervasive sadism cannot be explained away as the behavior of soldiers at war. It is part of what happens in settler colonialism. And so I think that that is a really important piece of what's happening now. And it's not only, you know, soldiers, it's American celebrities who have an affective attachment to the state of Israel, to Zion, to the Zionist project, and to their own, you know, identity as white women who are only ever victims. I mean, that's really the part of the collateral damage of that gender-only feminism, is it makes it impossible for us to see a wider angle of oppression.
When white anti-racists talk about fighting white supremacy, they often talk about how they do it not to save brown or black people, but as a way of saving themselves and their own people. At the end of your book, Nice White Ladies, you talk about the death of your mom. And so I'm curious about how does Zionism today and the struggles today continue that struggle for you?
So my mother took her own life when she was just 48 and I was 21. And it was very clear to me at that time, this is 1983, and it's even before I became a feminist, but it was really clear to me even in that moment that gender had something to do with what had shortened her life, because it had made her life smaller in various ways. There were just ways that she couldn't, you know, become more fully realized as a human being because of the way that gender constrained her life. And it took me longer to see how whiteness had shortened her life. But today, there's lots of research on what are sometimes called deaths of despair. These are untimely deaths among white people from drugs or alcohol or suicide. Or guns is another one. Jonathan Metzl has a wonderful book called Dying of Whiteness. And part of what he explains in this book is that there are certain policies, think of gun laws as an example, that become proxies for white identity. You know, even though it seems obvious to anyone who pays attention that guns are a danger to us as society, there are people who don't want to, you know, let go of their guns because it's part of who they are as white Americans, right? One of the other examples he gives is the ACA, sometimes known as Obamacare. He interviews somebody who's dying of liver liver disease and whose life would be saved or at least extended and made more comfortable if they would, you know, adopt Obamacare. And they quite pointedly say, I don't want that. That's for Mexicans and welfare queens, right? So this kind of idea that we would rather die of our whiteness than take action to step out of it and do something different, to me, is sort of at the heart of how whiteness is destroying us. And more specifically around the gender piece, in some ways, I think of my work as kind of a gendered analysis following on Metzl's. There's this other data in the epidemiological research that people refer to as a statistical anomaly that they can't really explain from these big epidemiological studies. And it's this: there's a spike in the number of deaths by suicide among white women between the ages of 48 and 64. And that's, you know, right at the age that my mother died. And my take on this is that it's the age at which white women age out of their usefulness and attractiveness to white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. This is part of what happened to my mother. She, you know, won the prize of marrying up in class, step and a half, when she married my father. She got the house in the suburbs. She got the prize of not working outside the home after I was born. But that prize was also a trap. And it was a trap that ultimately contributed to her death of despair. So to me, whiteness, I really think of it now as a kind of delusion, a kind of collective psychosis, if you will. And it's why I use the phrase white raised. I don't identify as white. I'm white raised. Lots of people I know are raised in a particular faith, a tradition, and then as adults think differently about that. Like my friends who refer to themselves as recovering Catholics, for example, right? And I think we need to start considering whiteness in the same way, as in, I was raised white, but I no longer buy into that. Of course, I recognize that there are all sorts of material advantages that adhere to whiteness, but what I'm talking about here is our affective attachment to it. And I've come to think of Zionism as similar to whiteness in this way. And in fact, we could think of them as two circles that significantly overlap, as in a Venn diagram. And as we've seen with the activism by many of our Jewish friends, colleagues, and comrades, there's a way to say, I was raised in Zionism, but I see through that now as propaganda in the service of an apartheid state, and I no longer believe in that. I see this as kind of a beginning that can get us closer to a liberatory future. It's not enough, but it's a good start.
Thank you for joining us for The Trouble with White Feminism. You can find the link to some of what we've mentioned in the show and the transcript of our conversation in the episode notes and on our website, criticalzionismstudies.org.